So I'm going to sort of do two things here. The thing that I was planning to do was to continue this conversation from last week about the relationship between samatha and vipassana. And in the meditation, we practiced a kind of instruction that's really common in the insight tradition right now, which is a kind of hybrid samatha-vipassana. The samatha side is the holding of a steady anchor, the anchor of the body and breath, something to come back to. And the vipassana side is holding that lightly, so not trying to resist all distraction whatsoever, but seeing where the attention goes, either to other parts of the sensory field or to the cognitive or emotional field, and really encountering what it finds there. The heart of this distinction is between the aspect of practice that is a training of attention to stabilize very deeply, and a part of practice that is a training of attention to understand what arises in the natural flow of sensory experience, to understand sensory existence as marked by impermanence, marked by selflessness, marked by unsatisfactoriness. So that's part of the topic we want to touch into, and then of course just through this whole conversation we just had with the recording off in our sharing time around some of the differences between the traditions. Some of the differences between the traditions, arose over time historically around interpretations and different ways of practicing with these two basic forms or, these two poles of meditative practice. In the Mahayana traditions, the traditions that arose probably as early as a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha and really developed into the first centuries of the Common Era through the writing of these texts called the Perfection of Wisdom texts. The Mahayana took the implication, it seems, of some of the states that are contactable in deep samadhi, the implication of some of the states where you touch into a kind of vastness that really really blows apart any idea about the fixed self, the small self, and can even really blow apart ideas of individual liberation, really. Into a kind of visionary space. It seems like the Mahayana movement took some of those meditative experiences, deep samadhi experiences, mixed with some of the first seeds of teachings on things like emptiness, and really developed them into schools of philosophical thought and investigation. One of the very interesting practice suggestions that I've heard is that the Mahayana schools have this extraordinary visionary literature. The texts of the Mahayana are full of, cosmic Buddhas radiating light throughout the countless known universes, teaching assemblies of bodhisattvas who assemble from the divine realms in these kind of infinite arrays of immaterial presence. And that some of this may have come out of deep visionary practice, deep samadhi practice. And that as these traditions developed, there began to mix an element of practice that was present in the earliest layer with some of these new visionary ideas. One of the main practice forms that arises and becomes very central to later Mahayana, particularly Tantra, in the Himalayas, is the practice of visualization. Visualization and mantra become very central. And there's a really interesting idea that has arisen that the visualization practices begin as a development of a natural phenomena that comes in very deep meditation, in samadhi practice, called the nimitta. So when one is practicing toward states known as jhana, the absorption states, toward several levels of jhana immersed in form, and then other states called formless states, sometimes called formless jhanas, the arupas, that bring one into contact with experiences called things like the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, that these states, when one begins to near jhana, a phenomena can happen that is mysterious. It seems to be a natural phenomenon that happens when the mind gets very, very, very still and energy is full. So piti, energy is full. Sukha, pleasure, bliss, happiness is quite full. And attention is extraordinarily stabilized and unwavering. This thing can happen where the object of one's meditation, the thing you're paying attention to, can be joined by, or in some cases replaced by, a kind of image. When we say image, it's not always visual. Some of the most common ones are visual, but they can also be a felt sense or an auditory sense sometimes. They get described differently. But like one of the classic ones is the breath nimitta. If you're doing practice, mindfulness of breathing, that for some folks, when attention becomes extraordinarily stabilized, an image of often a whitish light can begin to appear, sometimes like a cloudy light, sometimes getting stronger. And eventually you can cultivate that till it fills awareness. That this phenomena becomes something that one can harness. And there are traditions where one would develop a nimitta, so concentrate very deeply, enter jhana, be able to give rise to this kind of light or this kind of, you know, it's like a mental image of the meditative object. There are nimitta for loving kindness, for instance. If you're meditating on loving kindness, there can be an image or a felt sense that can come as the nimitta or the sign. It's technically called the counterpart sign. It's one of the names for it. This all gets super technical, so I'm being a little kind of skimming the surface here. But that these things can arise, and there are traditions that would say, oh, you take that, you develop a nimitta, and then you place it at different parts of the body. You know, you develop a nimitta of this color, and you put it in the belly, or you put it in the heart. And for some of you who know the yoga literature, this might start to sound like visualizations with the chakras. So that's one piece that seems to have, slowly morphed into what would become like mantra and visualization practice. And the other is ways of coming into meditation using images known as kasina. And this is a very ancient form of meditation where the meditator makes usually like a disc, like a physical object, that is in a very smooth color, white or blue, yellow, or an element color like smeared with mud, so earth. Or you can use a bowl of water for water, you can use fire. There's a whole range of these, and they're described in the commentary known as the Visuddhimagga. And the idea with casino practice is that you look at the object, the casino, and you put it on the wall in front of you when you're practicing. And you look at it until your attention can become absorbed in the color. So the color white, for the white casino, it's one of the most common, begins to fill your attention. And when it becomes pervasive, then you shift your attention just to, you can close your eyes and the color is still there, and you let it fill your field, and you can enter jhana based on this casino, based on this image. And there's the idea that these early practices then developed into tantric practices of visualization. Visualization often then would combine with mantras, images of deities. They would cross over into, you know, various kind of magical practices, practices to affect the material world through the use of mantra. And as these practices spread to different countries, you know, they were taken by travelers, and, you know, texts were translated. But then once they were there, they really developed, you know, very much on their own. So, you know, texts were taken to Tibet or to China. Chinese texts were taken to Japan, and there they developed, and they would often develop, you know, they developed in a way that took on characteristics of the culture that they arrived in. So, you know, when South Asian traditions were taken to China, they took on some things that were central to Chinese culture. One very central one was veneration of ancestors. That was not present in the early Buddhist world as much. It's present a little bit in the prayers and spells that you can do to release your relatives from the hungry ghost realm. If you have relatives that didn't have such a skillful life and they got a bad rebirth as a ghost, there are certain ways that you can practice to release them from that realm and give them a better rebirth. But based in that, the Chinese developed a much more complex and deep the rooted system of ancestor veneration, because that was central to Chinese culture. And it was only through that and some evolutions in theory, particularly about the transferability of merit, if you must know, particularly that allowed Buddhism to blossom in China. You know, and then once there, it took on things like Taoist nature mysticism, and all of that helped grow into Zen. Into what we know now known as Chan in Chinese, Zen in Japanese, Son in Korean, Tien in Vietnamese. But all of those words, Chan, Zen, Son, they're all transliterations of the Sanskrit word dhyana, which was a version of the word jhana for meditation. So they're meditation-based traditions. But when they arrived in the West in the 20th century, they arrived after, you know, 1,000+ years, 1,500 years of development in their home countries. And so, you know, many of us now are influenced, for instance, by the meditation instructions from the Soto Zen tradition, like the tradition of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco, where they practice Shikantaza, which they translate as just sitting. And when I was in Zen, I was in a different lineage. I was in a Rinzai lineage, but we also got instructions. When I got my first meditation instruction in Zen, it was really a postural instruction. You know, they said, can you sit in full lotus? I said, meh, not for very long. They said, okay, do half lotus. Make sure your back is really, really straight. They put a stick against my back to make sure it was really, really, really straight. Stick out your chest a little bit. Hold your hands exactly like this, right at your navel. Don't let them slump. And, you know, imagine there's an egg under your armpits. And then, you know, let your gaze rest down. Don't let your eyes close, half open. You know, bow at the beginning of the sitting, bow at the end. And that was the instruction, essentially. And I was like, well, what do I do once I'm there? You know, and they're like, just sit, you know. So that instruction, right, is a beautiful instruction in the context of Zen, in the context of the Zen ritual of the temple and what how that practice goes. How might we, like taking that as just as an example, how might we understand that instruction in light of, you know, the instructions that we use on jhana, you know, to gather the attention into one one object and really keep it there, really not allow the mind to wander as best we can. Is it the same? It's not quite the same, is it? Or the instructions in vipassana, to let the like in Mahasi style vipassana, to let the attention go where it will, but to notice where it goes and to attend to it very closely, to be intimate with each thing as it arises and notice it's arising and passing. Maybe the Zen instruction to just sit, if we abstract it to mean just sit and let everything else come and go, like don't try to stop anything from happening or make anything happen, maybe it's close to the Vipassana instruction, but maybe it's not actually. Maybe they're actually quite different instructions. And maybe actually the Zen instruction is appropriate for not abstracted out of the Zen ritual, right? So, you know, when is that instruction given? That instruction is given in a context where you've just been taught to step into the Zendo with the foot closest to the lintel of the door, and then to bow, and to bow at the to the shoji, who is the monk or nun who takes care of the students, and then to walk to your seat and bow to your cushion, and then bow to the room, and then stand and chant the Heart Sutra fast, and, you know, and to stand essentially at attention with your robes tied perfectly while incense is offered and the bows are done, and then to sit all together, you know, in the same moment with the clap of wooden clappers, and to arrange your robes until the whole row is perfectly aligned, all the knees lined up, no one out of place, forward or back, and then everyone takes the cosmic mudra right there, and then there's a bell and stillness, right? And there's the scent of the incense, and there's the sense of being in the Zendo with everyone else. What if the instruction in Shikantaza is not a meditation instruction in the abstract, but is an instruction to support sitting in exactly that context in the Zendo, in that very clear, you know, formalized ritual. And that maybe the Mahasi instruction, right, which is to note things as they arise, what if that is actually not a random instruction to do at any old meditation in your home, but is the instruction that was crafted to work wonders on an intensive 10-day retreat for lay people in Burma who are doing whatever they can to give rise to the states of mind that trigger the process of insight in the commentarial tradition. And that instruction, and it goes along with moving in slow motion through the whole day, for instance. What if that instruction is distinct to that cultural experience and that ritual, right? And the whole thing comes together. And I'm saying what if, but which is a little bit rhetorical. I think what I want to propose is that particularly with, let's say, meditation instructions, but it's true for any of the teachings of the Dharma, that we endeavor to understand them in a less dissociated from their context kind of way. So that we understand the Mahasi noting practice in the context of moving the body very slowly, for instance. And maybe we understand it largely in the context of retreat, or we have to modify it to take it into our ordinary life, where I'm not moving in slow motion through the whole day. You know, when I initially came out of Zen, you know, doing a lot of Zen in my 20s, and I was practicing at home, I didn't just sit down to meditate. That didn't really make sense to me. What made sense to me was that I put together a really crisp Zen altar as best I could. I got a bit of sand mixed with a bunch of incense from one of the incense bowls at the temple, because the incense burner is a bowl full of ash that you put the stick in. And I set up a Zen altar, and then I tried to do the Zen ritual, right? I would stand, I would hold the incense between my fingers just so, I would offer it, I would do the chant as best I could alone, I would do the full bows, and then I would sit with the, you know, with the cosmic mudra and my back, you know, clear. And that's how it felt right to practice in that tradition, because I couldn't do the meditation outside of the context of the whole ritual. It was actually a ritual meditation. And so as the different threads have moved to different cultures, right, of course they change. You know, of course, modern secular mindfulness, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction, it's a new sect of the Dharma. I disagree with some of its basic tenets, but the foundational practice is solid, you know, and it reflects the cultural context of its birth, you know, a hospital in Massachusetts in the 1980s. It reflects the needs of the people in that exact place. And I think it's on us as sincere students of the Dharma in a postmodern, post-colonial world. Post-colonial, by the way, I'm using the term tonight, doesn't mean that the colonial period is over. It means that the colonial period is established. And so everything in the world now is affected by the colonial process that unfolded between the 17th and 19th centuries, largely, and then unraveled or changed dramatically into its next form in the 20th century as so many of the colonized countries gained independence, technical or putative independence, perhaps, but were irrevocably changed by the process of colonialism. And so the term post-colonial refers to, you know, the whole of the world now affected by those cultural contacts that happened as a result of the colonial process and the various traumas and dislocations and evolutions that happened as a result of that. So it's neither a pejorative nor completely neutral, but it's a descriptor. So, you know, everything in the Dharma now, in almost all of its cultures, but certainly in Europe and North America and Australia and any of the places where a culturally specific Dharma tradition moved quickly in the 20th century, contains these frictions and vibrations of cultural contact. Essentially, you know, the nature of the colonial encounter is that the cultural contact was fast rather than slow. You know, the contact between the South Indian Mahayanists and the Northern Chinese Mahayanists, those cultures were very different, but the contact was very slow, and it was over centuries, and it was essentially neighbors talking to each other, you know, bit by bit over a long period of time. And just the fundamental difference when the Europeans arrive on their ships with their armies, and the contact is very swift, and they're not neighbors actually in the same way, right? The colonial forces have come from very far away with very different stories and myths and cultures and diseases and practices and rituals and religions. And so our process now is to find our way wherever in the post-colonial world, wherever in the world we find our roots and we get our learning from, to figure out what to do with the kind of sometimes overwhelming profusion of traditions that have collided here. And with the internet, every tradition from virtually everywhere is accessible, with a few blessed exceptions hiding out deep in the jungles and places. It's on us as folks with power and privilege and, you know, internet access and money to spend and all of that to figure out with our hearts and our minds clear both how to be good citizens in the postmodern world in terms of the Dharma, in terms of everything really, and how to be unconfused in ourselves as spiritual practitioners, like what's going to actually work for my path. And just speaking for myself, I know that mashing up, to go back to the basic meditation instruction, that mashing up the instructions for Shikantaza, the instructions for koan practice, the non-dual instruction to understand everything as Buddha nature, the instructions for jhana, the instructions for vipassana from the five different vipassana traditions I studied in, that actually I can't do all of that in any mashed up way. It's, for me, in my mind, it's way too confusing. And so I try to do one thing at a time and figure out what is helpful in this phase of my life that can actually unfold and further the path. So I think where this ends is a plea for discernment as we find our way in the Dharma in this moment on the planet. All right, so I don't know if that was or wasn't what was planned for tonight, but there you go. There's a bit of that.